You've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
What's up, Launch Street? Tamara here. Looking forward to yet another day of thinking differently. Hope you are too. I have some great news. We are adding a second day to our podcast. Hooray! For the past, I don't know, six-ish months, we have just been flooded with requests from listeners like you to do more than one a week. And we have all these guests that we can't fit in with our current format. So you asked, we listened. One more day, double the guests, double the insights every week. Stay tuned. More to come on when this is going to launch. Now, for today's guest, Alan Sylvan. So there's been this massive shift in the business world from brands and businesses going from being a passive stage for culture to one of an active challenger of culture. I think we're seeing it with the Nike ads, with Target, with what a lot of the brands are doing out there right now. I think the role of business in people's personal lives is just very different than it was 10 years ago, or the relationship and what we expect of those businesses has changed. And that change requires us all to think differently about the businesses and the brands and the work that we lead and do every single day. So to talk more about this, I brought on Alan, who is the CEO of Sylvamp Labs. He champions the application of imagination, science, and a little whimsy to identify new product and brand opportunities that could change the world. So this approach has led him and his company to create lasting growth and results for clients like Google, Spotify, GM, InBev, PepsiCo, Patagonia, Airbnb, the list goes on. But their mission at his company is to leverage the might of large companies for the greater good. Let's hear what he has to say.
Alan, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. This is going to be fun, I hope.
I hope. We'll see. We'll see how it goes. Especially given the business you're in, I'm very curious your answer to this question. What's your favorite innovative brand or business, and why do you love them so much?
No, thanks for asking that. You know, it's easy to answer this question with a brand like Amazon or Tesla.
Yeah,
in fact,
totally.
You know, I love Amazon, and I'm kind of blown away by them, by as a business. That's the way I love them, although there are issues there, of course. But when it comes to your question, what I admire most are probably the businesses that are derived out of the music industry and music brands, really. And music brands are sort of, and when I say music brands, I'm talking about like bands, really, and artists, and how they themselves are so well branded that they represent more than just the music that they make. And they represent lifestyle, they represent identity, they represent expression and creativity. And I think there's a lot that corporate brands can learn from artist brands or music brands. You know, you think about the way people rock a Metallica t-shirt, or you think about the way, you know, people feel Kanye represents them on a deeper level. You know, those are things that have nothing to do with music. Those are things that have to do with self-identity and shared value systems. And that's stuff that we talk a lot about when it comes to corporate branding. How can we emulate some of that gravitas that music brands have?
So do you have, what's your favorite brand, band or musical group?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I wish I had a better answer. When it comes to my own taste, it would probably be something around hip hop or something like that. But, you know, the Kiss brand is pretty amazing. I don't really know Kiss music, but I know the brand. I know the lifestyle. I know what it represents. I know, you know, it's definitely a bit of a caricature of itself when it comes to merchandising. But in terms of an idea, and you know, that's a brand I appreciate. I don't know if I'd say I love it, but I appreciate it for sure.
And I think if you look at the bands, so I'm a Gen Xer. I'm in my 40s, so I grew up on hip hop and like that kind of whole era. And I'm from California, so all in that. And what I think is cool is if you look at the bands from the 80s, that have really, or musical artists or whatever, who have actually sustained, they treated their music, not the music, but themselves like a brand and a business and not just an artist who randomly made some music. Like they really, Bon Jovi actually has a great interview about this, about Bon Jovi being a brand from the beginning.
Yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah.
So, I presented to, and I don't present to celebrities often, don't get the wrong impression, and I'm not name dropping, this is not what this is, but one time I presented to Bono. It was pretty cool. And I presented to Bono, and he was trying to make a point, and he went on, he told a story about how U2 was a brand from the very beginning, just like you said, and that they sort of thought about themselves as a sort of a value system and an idea versus, you know, three or four players that come together and play music. They came over from Dublin thinking that they were bringing over this brand for American listeners. And when they thought of it that way, it kind of changed the potential and stuff. So
that's brilliant. And I have to ask, for real, is he as cool in person as he is on TV and everywhere else you see him? Like he is, isn't he?
He's cool. He's a rock star, you know, but what struck me was how small he was. And, you know, I remember shaking his hand and being like, wow, my hand is far bigger than Bono's hand.
Like, what is that? Odd thing to think too, right?
Like, the narcissist that I am.
Well, I this is total tangent, but I can't tell you. I'm 5'9" about, and I can't tell you the number of, because I lived in New York City for many years. Like, you see actors, actresses, rocks, you see them everywhere in New York. And the number of times I've thought, I'm a lot taller than that person. Interesting. Would not have guessed that on camera.
Yeah, it's funny.
I know. All right. I took off tangent, but I want to kind of go back to what you do, because one of the things that, and I think this conversation actually leads in terms of how you talked about music, but one of the things that you do is you have this combination of imagination, science, and a little whimsy. And that's kind of how you talk about your work. So share what that means to bring those three things together.
Yeah, actually, it's just science and whimsy is how we usually talk about it. Imagination is a way that we use to explain it. But the concept itself is what we say on our site is our tools are science and whimsy. And what we mean by that is we sort of take an alchemy of rigor, discipline, business, analysis, academia, with imagination, curiosity, creativity, experimentation. And a lot of people talk about left and right brain thinking, and so there's nothing novel there. But what we try to do is really create an alchemy of those things. So it's not two things that coexist. It's one thing that is a combination of both, you know, your creative spirit and your sort of instinct for discipline. And clients want that. You know, clients want what they get from management consultants. They want the confidence. And they want the rigor, but they also want to be taken on a journey and to be triggered emotionally and to identify with something. They want empathy in a partner. And so what we try to do in everything that we do, we try to combine those two things. So we're not compromising ever. So that's what science and whimsy is sort of a reminder for us. It's like the science as well as like the magic and the whimsy.
So will you give me an example of either a client that you work with or just someone in the marketplace who you think does that really well of the combination?
I think it's hard to say because, you know, all brands try to do that well, you know, through advertising and through brand promises. But I think few, to be honest with you, I think very, very few actually can do that, can do a combination of science whimsy. I think when I think about, you know, the world beyond brands. And I'm sorry for dodging your question, but if you think about the world beyond brands and you think about science in general or space travel in general, that is a combination of science and whimsy. You know, NASA is a brand that represents science whimsy because
That's a great example.
Right. It's part like aeronautics and, you know, physics and engineering, but also it's about exploration and the great unknown. And, you know, inspiring us about what the future can be. So that might be a good example. But it's hard to think of corporations that do it, you know?
Can I add to that, too, what you're saying with NASA? I think the other cool thing about that is in order to build something to go to Mars, you have to imagine that that's even possible to begin with, right? There's whimsy in the idea of we could take someone to Mars or Saturn or whatever it is. and originally to the moon. So there's that whimsy and kind of thinking possibly, like what's possible, combined with the rigor of science to actually figure out how to make it happen. And I think oftentimes, I'll kind of loop it back to business for a second. I think oftentimes we get so trapped in this is how we know how to do it that we lose the whimsy of we got to figure this out differently. So what if we erase the whiteboard and approach this in a new way, which to me is a little bit of the whimsy side of the science.
Oh, I love that. What you're getting at is like a sort of corporate hubris, you know, where there's a sense of like, we have one way of doing it and this is the way it's done. And we're never going to revisit it. You know, we're working right now with some finance clients, and it's really interesting to think about some of the conventions in that industry that we take for granted in terms of how brands speak to us and what products are served. And so the companies that are standing up, like Acorns and like, you know, Oscar in insurance, they're sort of throwing out the conventions of old and communicating like their video games or communicating like their lifestyle brands. And it's pretty, you're totally right that you can get much further when you kind of wipe clean the whiteboard. But can I just add one thing though?
Yeah.
That I think there's like a really stark appetite for the combination of science whimsy from the consumer point of view. That, and I, you know, that's why I was struggling to find a point of a brand that does it well. People really just want to have that sort of magic and that sort of discipline at the same time, and they don't know where to go to find it. So it's just an interesting need out there that I think a lot of brands can fulfill.
Yeah, that's a great point, and that kind of leads me to a question I really wanted to ask you about. Because I watched one of your keynotes, and there's something that you said that really stood out to me, because you're talking about what kind of customers want and what they're demanding. And you said, the role of brands is shifting from a passive stage of culture to an active challenger of culture. So from a passive stage of culture to an active challenger. Tell me more about that.
Well, brands really, in the past, they were sort of conduits for culture. They were sort of the investors and I think, you know, brands sort of had this passive role where they just sort of sat back and held up a mirror to society, maybe put up a celebrity and maybe talked about some lofty promise, you know, a cool guy on a horse smoking a cigarette. You know, it was kind of these aspirations, and it was fairly passive in that it wasn't controversial. It didn't carry any real consequential import. And brands really were passive. They were lean back and they were kind of absent. Mm. But the last 5 or 10 years, particularly with the recession and particularly with the political climate, consumers are wanting much more from brands. They want opinions and they're looking for brands to have a stake in culture. And so the best brands are evolving and being more purposeful. And purpose is a word that's thrown around a lot. So maybe that's not the only way to describe it, but brands are being much more intentional and active and making decisions. You know, we talk often about Colin Kaepernick and Nike and that partnership and what that meant as a good example, but there are bad examples here too, where brands are trying to be active challengers, but clumsily doing so. And I'm not a fan of the Gillette, the best a man can be campaign. Did you see that? Do you know what that is?
Yeah, I saw it. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a good example of like brand behavior gone wrong, you know, trying to challenge culture in a way as a positive example of marketing in culture today. But I see it as a little bit opportunistic on the part of that brand. And you know, I think it was an attempt to be an active challenger of culture. But ultimately, I think as savvy consumers see it as a little bit more you know, one-dimensional, if I could say that.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I was not impressed with the ad. I also think that as consumers, we're very good at sniffing out when it is truly them putting a stake in the ground and when it's like, let's jump on the bandwagon. And I think that like Pepsi and their protest ad was a great example of like, clearly, at least that's, I wasn't the people, I don't work for Pepsi, so I don't have, you know, I don't actually know what they were thinking, but it definitely came across as, look at us, we're jumping on the bandwagon. And because of that, it was totally wrong.
Totally.
So, I mean, and Nike, right? You love it or hate it with the Colin Kaepernick, but you have an opinion about it because it's clear that they have an opinion.
Exactly. And I think even people who don't agree with it admire the, you know, the ability to take a stand and have an opinion, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know, that's what was interesting about Nike, is that I think the people that oppose, you know, taking a knee or whatever, they're not necessarily stopping in their purchasing of Nike. You know, maybe there's like a marginal few that are extreme that want to make a political stand with their consumption habits.
Right.
But I would say that for the most part, this is very much on brand for Nike, you know, to take a stand and have a point of view. And it doesn't stop there, right? It's like, you know, they did this amazing work around women in sports and the power of sports for women. And that too, you know, it's a different idea, but it's equally as, you know, charged and important.
Well, I think that goes back to what you were saying earlier around, like, there's a difference between putting out an ad and making it a part of your business, which is, is really what you do, right, at Sylvain Labs, is you leverage the might of large companies for the greater good. So
that's right.
How do you do that?
Well, you know, I wish I had a good answer for you. It's not really, you know, I'm just
not
being
a one-size-fits-all. Yeah.
No, this, that's our mission, even, to leverage the might of corporations for the greater good. And what that is, it's a reminder for us that this is a great responsibility and privilege in helping companies shape their brands and their products, which is what we do. You know, we not only help, we create brand ideas, but we also help clients develop product ideas and go to market strategies and so on. And so that mission statement is a reminder that in everything we do and every recommendation we make, we need to make sure we are in fact serving the greater good. And the way we do it on a day-to-day basis, we're still figuring out, but there are little things like really being more mindful of the environmental impact of a recommendation. You know, we work with Colgate-Palmolive, for example, and they are mass producers and they consume a lot of plastic. And, you know, when we make a recommendation on a new product, whether it's a new toothbrush or whatever it is, we are really factoring that consequence into our recommendation. Or thinking about our work with Google and data privacy, or, you know, any of the other brand, every brand has sort of a bigger ethical question at play. And we try to weave that into that. Now, in addition to all that, in addition to our client work, we try to serve our communities as much as possible. So that means our company, our employees, you know, we try to kind of adopt policies that are really in the best interest of the people here. We became a certified B Corporation as part of that. We also, you know, volunteer and give a portion of our profits. And, you know, it's the reason there isn't a good answer here is because it's all very instinctual and maybe we need more process around it right now, but that's really what we're trying to do, is to leverage the might of corporation. And you know, the last thing I would say about that is it's a personal mission. You know, I don't know how you feel tomorrow, but for me, you know, working with some of the companies and brands that we work with, and you mentioned PepsiCo, for example, that a mass producer and consumer of high fructose corn syrup, which contributes to the obesity crisis, I feel like I need to redeem my work. You know, I need to feel like what I'm doing is important and meaningful in the world. And so I view my role very much in sort of shaping what these companies are doing for the greater good, even if it's not well-defined. But if every decision we make has got a little bit of that at play, then I feel a little better about going to work, I guess.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. So I spent 20 years doing new product development for very large consumer packaged goods companies. Wonderful people, wonderful products that I consume all the time. But I got really tired or frustrated with spending my time putting more junk out into the world. And I know that sounds horrible, but that's ultimately, it's just clutter, really, and too many options and too much stuff. And it was funny when I switched, it's part of the reason why my business is really focused on how do I help people in the world be more innovative so they can solve their problems and so that we can solve the world's problems. Like I really see what we do at Launch Street as the good that we do is about giving people the tool, the mental tools to create change. And though some of those people are in those big companies, some of them are independent and all of it's awesome. But to your point, like if I can do a little bit of good, because you know what? I also love my air conditioning and my, you know, like I don't have a big compost in my backyard. I want to do things that I feel connected to, and I want to feel like I can personally make an impact. So So yeah, so I hear what you're saying. And all of it's good. I'm not bashing large companies. Like, I love the people that are my clients and my friends. And I think all of us are trying to do a little bit more good in the world today, given just where we are. I think we all see the value of that. So my question back to you on that is, I'm curious why, so if I'm a leader in a company, whatever that company is, but I'm not in the do good department, right? They all have these departments that are like, here are the people that work on charitable giving and whatever. Why should I care about it if I'm over here in, I don't know, operations, marketing, finance, whatever?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there are a number of reasons. You know, one, and I'll try to rattle off a few. One is that the end consumer of the company you work for wants that from the company itself. So, you know, consumers want to, patronize brands that have purpose and greater meaning. That's a new thing. That didn't exist, you know, 30 years ago in the same way. You know, I don't know what's in your medicine cabinet or what's in your fridge, but a lot of the brands that a lot of us are picking nowadays are ones that have a little bit more gravitas in terms of what they're doing. So that's one reason. Mm-hmm. If you work in a marketing department, you should care about the purpose of your employer. You know, if you work in finance or in any other department, another piece of data that we're seeing is that employees feel much more engaged when they work for a company or a leader that has a purpose or vision. That's bigger than just profit.
Interesting. Yeah.
You mentioned you're a Gen Xer, so my millennials over-index like crazy when it comes to this. They will take a pay cut. They'll be retained for longer if their employer has a sort of a higher purpose, which is, by the way, another reason that we created a mission is because I want to give the people that I work with a greater sort of promise to engage in. So I think there are a number of reasons, and I think what we're seeing is sort of the corporate world reckoning with its impact in the world. And it took hundreds of years for that to happen. But I think with the recession and, again, with the political climate and the rise of technology and all these things, we're sort of at a moment now where corporations' role in society is evolving beyond creating returns for investors. It's sort of playing more of a societal role. I mean, people identify with brands more than they identify with religions or governments. You know,
isn't
people
that
are more likely
fascinating? To fascinating.
It's crazy, you right? Know, like people.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I was just having this conversation with someone the other day. I said, you know, particularly here in the U.S., I think we're having a real political crisis. Overall, and there's a lot of debate and legislation around really moral topics. And what I find fascinating about it is, and I was telling someone else, and I'd love to hear your perspective on this. I said, I don't think government's gonna decide where we go with their legislations and their rhetoric. I think business is gonna determine. And like, if you look at Target, for example, the one down by me anyway has a lot of LGBTQ stuff. Spread out, you know, through the store, like really very blatantly. And I think it's awesome. So I shop there and I support Target, but I also feel like Target's out there saying, hey, this is like, we're all humans. This is good. And so I think business is going to be our moral bellwether, if that's the right phrase, and government's just going to lag behind.
Yeah, I think it's really provocative and interesting. You know, if you look at the incept or all the philosophy around the role of corporations in society, it's just that.
Yeah.
It's these kind of organizing principles that bring people together, employ them, allow people to sustain their lifestyles. And what I find interesting about what you're saying is it's only becoming obvious now, you know, and I'm down here in downtown Manhattan. If you walk down Broadway, I see a lot of the same things you just pointed out, like all of the boutiques and fashion brands have like a rainbow flag, and it's awesome. It's amazing to see Broadway embrace, you know, gay rights in a way that's so important. Now, corporations have always played a role in government, but just a very kind of subversive one, so to speak. Like the lobbies, you know, Philip Morris and tobacco have been a huge part of government legislation. The food industry has been a huge part of food in legislation. So it's interesting that the role of companies are changing from like advocating for their own interests to much more purpose, meaningful change stuff. You know, like Target, there's like a Retail Association of America that's, you know, lobbies for things in DC, and that's what Target invested in for decades, but you're seeing a whole other dimension of Target's character in the store, which is fantastic. It's like companies are now coming into their own, you know?
Yeah. It's actually really exciting. It's really exciting, and it'll be fascinating to see how it all plays out. But really, I mean, I could go on and on about this one thing and what's happening, particularly in the U.S., but I think it's happening around the globe too, from what I can see. I think we're just it's very hyper-intensified right now here. But I want to loop it back to innovation. How does having a culture of good, or that's really focused on the greater good, help you as a company and as your people in the company actually drive innovation and innovative solutions?
Well, I think when people are in service of a higher order principle, beyond profits or beyond revenue, or in addition to those things, I think there's a greater opportunity for creativity. And that's where new things can really arise. You know, like, for example, a phenomenon like crowdfunding, you know, which came that's very much a purposeful technology, in that it's really, you know, creating power among the collective. And there's some corporate applications to that that have actually been really good for business and brands and society. You think about, you know, Google in itself is a beneficiary of this kind of crowd mentality, in that the search results are based on, you know, how prevalent or clicked on the results are. But so, you know, so are things like Airbnb and Spotify playlists. And everywhere we go, we're seeing this kind of crowd mentality manifesting itself. So I think it's a good example of when you've got a higher order purpose, which in this case was about democracy and giving everyone the equal say, really interesting things come out of it. Really interesting technologies can come out of that, as opposed to, you know, the founder of, Spotify, for example, could have been thinking about how do I sell more CDs, you know, in an industry that was dying. But instead, what they did was they looked at how can we leverage everyone's musical tastes to better curate what people want. And that was a very collective mindset. It's no coincidence that it came from a place like Sweden, where there was a bit more of a collective mindset.
It's so interesting. The woman I just interviewed for a separate podcast, she's the CEO of a tech solution company. Her favorite innovative brand was Spotify, because that's how she discovers new music.
Mm-hmm. Spotify's a client. Full disclosure, Spotify's a client.
Just tell them they were just mentioned multiple times.
Multiple times. No, I'm a big fan. I was a big fan of Spotify before we started working with them. Yeah. And you're absolutely right. You know, the power of the algorithm is what makes them different than any other vendor. Yeah. This is not sure. They should charge. You should charge them. Send them an invoice.
You know what? I'm going to, because I've now talked about them on four podcasts. So tell them to call me. Though I will say that what you're saying, though, I think is important, not to kind of, you know, jump over about Spotify, is when you democratize innovation and people feel engaged because they have purpose, amazing things come out of it. And those two things are a recipe for incredible success inside a company and then ultimately in the marketplace.
Yes, absolutely. It's exactly it. You know, the innovation has been democratized because of technology and access. And so there's just a greater a volume of ideas. The negative side of all this is that everyone feels like an entrepreneur and feels like they have the right to innovate, and they can innovate, and every idea is a good idea. And that's an interesting thing we're seeing in this culture of innovation, that there's a sort of a backlash because there's a gluttony of ideas now. You know, everyone can be an entrepreneur. All you got to do is watch Shark Tank.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, it's this, we're now in a culture where innovation is so prevalent that everyone believes that they can do it. And of course, it's not true. And of course, not every idea is good valuable or feasible. And so I think we're at an interesting point where, on the one end, innovation is all the rage, which is important and valuable, but it's also a little cliche and overused and sort of, you know, democratized to an extreme.
I think it's an interesting perspective I hadn't really thought about, and it kind of clutters the playing field too, right? The benefit is the barriers to entry to innovate in any way are the lowest they've ever been. Awesome. The downside to that is anyone can innovate. So now you've got a million competitors, right? And my kind of question for entrepreneurs and leaders out there is always, you know, how do you leverage your people to think like innovators and to be that in the work that they have right in front of them versus just thinking about innovation as like, I'm gonna go create a new product and service. But how do I, so if I'm in charge of operations, how do I innovate the processes to work faster and smarter, right? All the things that we need. If I'm in marketing, how do I innovate in a way that I put our stuff out into the world so people pay attention? Because to me, that's more powerful for companies than coming up with a bunch of people with a bunch of ideas. Because to your point, that's just cluttering the playing field and everybody's off on their own.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we provide services where we help clients create, you know, create a culture of innovation. And we you know, there are outsiders you can go to that can help bring that spirit of innovation inside. But what's disturbing about that is that companies are outsourcing their entrepreneurial spirit, really. They're outsourcing their innovation spirit. What I find useful in companies when it comes to entrepreneurs is when these people feel like they have a personal stake in the success. When they behave more like...
They act like owners.
Exactly. They behave more like owners as opposed to, you know, people who work for someone else.
Yep.
I have clients that work on products that have been turning over like crazy. You know, people turn over like crazy, but it's the same product and the same brand is there. And we've been working on it longer than some of the clients have. So it's, you know, but on the other hand, when you see some clients create incentive structures and other performance measures that really make employees feel like they're in it. Yeah. You know,
right.
This is something at stake here.
Yeah. I mean, I hear you. And I think to your kind of, a lot of what we're talking about here, we're at this interesting tipping point in business and in culture where those two things are really coming together, and innovation, where those three things, I should say, are coming together in a way that's more powerful. But what we also have to be is more responsible with how we think about all those things. Because they're not siloed anymore and they're not one-offs anymore. Is that fair to say, do you think?
I do. I think that's true. I mean, everything is sort of connected to each other nowadays. But I agree completely.
What do you think stops people from, I actually want to ask you kind of two questions wrapped into one, because the answer might be together or separate, but what do you think stops people from focusing on the greater good, and what do you think stops them from innovating?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the number one thing that stops people from thinking about the greater good is the motive for profit and revenue. And that's a very, like a short-term motive, like a short-term mindset. In that we need to sell. And that's,
yes.
And people are willing to compromise the greater good and values in a heartbeat in service of that motivation. And what happens is they end up making products that aren't innovative, that are really just solving sort of an immediate need. I was reading about fast fashion recently and just how, you know, horrible it is for the environment and so on. And there's no innovation there. You know, there's very little innovation, I should say. You know, H&M isn't necessarily thinking about how can they create products that are more enduring.
Right.
Or so it's not in the business model. The business model is fast fashion, which is wasteful. So I think there's a desperate need to bring innovation to your question about good. And they work hand in hand. But yeah, the motive for profits is toxic alluring and can, you know, make people drunk. Forget.
Right. I think that's a great way to say it. And you're absolutely right. I guess the question really is, how do you think differently about how to do good or in a way that is innovative and connects with your business and your marketplace so that everybody wins?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a creative exercise.
Yeah.
It's an exercise in creativity. How can you really do what you do every day differently? And it's serves a greater value for you and the people you serve.
Do you think if you work in a large company, whatever it is, and let's say doing good is not their main driver, but you lead a team, can you apply it to the team level and say, okay, how do we as a team create this purpose, or does it have to be at the company level?
Well, I think it depends on the company. You know, I think founder-led companies have more of a right to sort of an easier time, I should say, to claim a purpose that the team aligns with. You know, it's easier to work for, Steve Jobs, for example, when he wants to advocate for the creative in all of us.
Right,
you know, it's like,
right.
Yeah, that will mobilize people. When it's a sort of a faceless organization, I think it can be a challenge. But also, I mean, I think it's important that the organization itself has a sort of a shared spirit and a shared value system, so that the reason people are together isn't only to make products and sell them. It's sort of to create new things and be together. And when you think of it that way, not only do you create value for other, for your clients, but you also create sort of a valuable system people want to be in.
Right.
And people, you know, when I think about what my product is, for example, at Sylvain Labs, like, what is our product? Yes, to a certain degree, it is strategic consulting and design, but it's also, the product is sort of this shared mindset. This idea of being together and trying to do something new. That's a bit of what I'm making. It's on the manufacturing line. It's a shared identity.
Before I could keep going, but we're out of time. So before we have to close, where can people go to learn more and connect?
Oh, thanks for asking. Sylvain Labs is the name of the site or is the URL for our site. That's sylvainlads.com. And, you know, at Sylvain Labs, you can find us anywhere.
Awesome. This has been fantastic. What's your final piece of advice for those of us trying to maybe be more innovative about how we do good with our work?
Well, I think my final piece of advice is just stay true to who you are and what you care about. And, you know, our personal selves should not be so distant and disconnected from our working selves. And I think there's a way to do it and to thrive in every respect. So I don't know if that's a piece of advice as much as it's sort of my life purpose, you know, I'm seeking to do. And I hope that could be valuable for other people.
Oh, thank you. And I love that what you said about kind of that personal and professional life coming together. I think all too often we buy into this myth of leave your personal life at the door when you walk through your office. And that's just ridiculous to me.
Exactly.
So for so many reasons, first of all, we don't sell to robots, right?
Exactly.
We sell to other humans. So thank you for that. It has been a pleasure having you on.
Yeah, thank you for this. Has been great.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, LaunchStreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.